Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts that we think you would enjoy. For word games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts, check out Ask Me Another. It's a rambunctious hour that blends brain teasers with comedy and music. Find Ask Me Another on iTunes under podcasts. And that is the music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we pay a visit to Book Expo, the enormous book industry trade show that brings publishers, booksellers, librarians, and even members of the media together to talk about upcoming books and decide which parties are the best parties. Then we'll take a listener suggestion and talk about the culture that helps us grieve, whether we're grieving for a person, a relationship, a job, or a plain old dashed set of hopes. We'll consider what gets us to the other side. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And Petra Mayer, what do you do at NPR?
I'm an editor with NPR Books, specializing in genre fiction.
And Petra is here with us in part because Petra, along with me, has just spent a few days at Book Expo. So Book Expo, I think that a lot of people out there in pop culture land, especially people on Twitter who follow writers, often have some vague sense that Book Expo exists and is a thing. You will also see it referred to as BEA because it is technically Book Expo America. But are not really sure exactly what Book Expo is. Book Expo, as I said, is a trade show. And so it takes place in the Javits Center in New York. Imagine, if you will, an enormous warehouse.
The Javits Center is something like six city blocks
long? It's several blocks long, yeah. And everything is crammed in there, as you would expect at any trade show or con or other crowded show floor. And all of the big publishers and many little teeny publishers have little booths. And a booth can be anything from the size of an office cubicle where some little tiny publisher has three books out on a table and will tell you that these are the three books they make, to Penguin or whoever will have a whole area of the Javits Center. And they will have a whole giant area where each of their imprints has people who are there to show the catalog and show...
And they're basically hawking their wares, or there are authors there? How...
It's a combination of both. Typically from the big publishers, you'll see sales reps in the booths who are there to take you through the catalogs and explain to you what they have. But they also do a lot of author signings.
One thing can I also say that I love about the big book pavilions like Random House and Penguin and HarperCollins is they have really cushy carpet.
Sure.
So if you're walking up and down the Javits Center all day long, which is what we were doing, going from meeting to meeting to meeting with all these publicists, when you get to walk onto one of those cushy carpeted publisher pavilions and you just kind of go, oh, God.
Mm-hmm.
I will cover any book you give me. Just let me stand here.
I've always said that the perfect promotional item at South by Southwest would be branded foot pads.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
Is there cosplay? Or is it just that everybody around you looks like
Humber Well, Humbert. No. BEA itself.
And Bridget Jones.
No, it's an industry trade show. Oh. Right? Historically, Book Expo has been an industry-only trade show. And this is the first year that they made one day open to the public, which is what's being called BookCon.
Yeah. I think they've had a chunk of BEA a couple times. It wasn't a con exactly, but it was like I think they called it like Power Reader Day or something like that. And it was partially open to the public. But this was the first year that the last day of BEA, they sealed off part of the Javits. And I mean, it was sealed off in the sense that if you only had a ticket for the con part, you could not get into the trade part.
Mm-hmm.
It was a thing that they called Book Con, and this was its first year, and it was organized by the same people that organized Comic Con, the same event company that organizes Comic Con. And so Book Con, Petra, you didn't go to Book Con, is that correct?
Well,
Petra was still in meetings.
I had my priorities. I had a bunch of publicist meetings in the morning, but my one goal, as Linda knows, my one goal for this whole event was to get my picture taken with Grumpy Cat. Because I have my priorities straight.
That's right.
You know.
Does Grumpy Cat have a book? Or,
yeah, she has a book. She had one last year. She was there last year, too.
She has another one,
This is
one,
her
right?
second book. Yeah. Grumpy Cat is a prolific author.
She's a trilogy.
Which is amazing because
you'd think Grumpy Cat would have run out of life experiences to chronicle in a book.
Especially
after.
So since by the time I fought my way through the hordes to the Chronicle Books booth, she was fast asleep. I mean, she was sacked out. But they did let me get up close with her and take a picture. Oh, the tiny little face. She's like, she's really cute.
She's so grumpy.
She's so grumpy.
And I should say, during the rest of BEA, there are also our panels that go on where they talk about, you know, marketing things and author marketing and how to use social media and all this kind of business. And there are throughout BEA, you know, famous people doing speeches, like, you know, appearing at breakfasts and lunches and stuff like that.
Are they doing readings?
No, they don't do readings, I don't think.
At BookCon, I think they did.
They did at BookCon. But the other thing they do throughout Book Expo is they do appear at the booths, at the various publisher booths.
You'll see these signing autographs.
Periodically, you'll see these huge snakes of people with Book Expo functionaries standing around with, I love this. This is new this year. Yeah. Signs saying, middle of the line. End of the line.
Yeah, and sometimes they'll have a picture of the author's head on the sign. Yeah. Like, they'll be standing there with a sign. It'll say, end of the line, and then your head.
Yes, exactly. Like,
on a pike.
Exactly.
It's weirdly dark.
Just not.
Well, so when I was there, for example, the Harlequin booth has romance writers in there all the time. But they have like four at a time, three or four at a time.
Mm-hmm. And there's always a huge line.
And these are, again, this is an industry trade show. Mm-hmm. So these are people who are somehow connected to the book industry who are waiting in super long lines to have books signed by approximately the people you would expect. Some of them are popular authors. The woman who writes the Bones books was signing one day, but also famous people, like we saw BJ Novak signing books in the Penguin booth.
And is there among the professional people in the publishing industry, is there squeeing? Or is it restricted to Grumpy Cat?
Petra, that was not Petra's only moment. Petra had another moment in which she did encounter an author, and she made what my friend and a writer herself, Pam Ribbon, calls fan face. But fortunately, Petra made fan face away from the author so that the author did not see her do it.
Sorry, who was the author?
Yeah, you can tell us.
It was David Mitchell who wrote Cloud Out.
Sure.
His new book out. But
he also ghost wrote the Grumpy Cat book.
Yeah, no, but the reason I was making fan face is that he made this adorable little mini speech, and he tried several different phrasings to get it right, and he finally settled on, "For the geeks have inherited the earth." And
it is true.
He was basically my new boyfriend after that.
Right. So I went to BookCon, and BookCon, it does have some of the feel of Comic-Con. That was more a thing where there are giant events in big halls where you go and sit with a lot of other people and listen to people basically on a panel talk. Some of them were bigger, some of them were smaller. But I think as the day wore on, they had a lot of problems with very long lines. A man by the name of John Green, who wrote a little book called The Fault in Our Stars, was speaking at 3 in the afternoon. And there were people lining up for that all day because there were a significant number of people who were at this book con only to have essentially an audience with John Green, meaning be in the back of a room full of several thousand people.
Well, that's what I wanted to touch on a little bit here is you're talking about on the trade show floor, you have a lot of people getting autographs. Mm-hmm. Like at South by Southwest, people are ostensibly crowding around to see bands perform. So here, is it to touch the hem of John Green's garment or?
It's to be in the thing, I think.
But he's talking, right?
The Book Expo also is primarily a book discovery thing. Another thing that they're doing at these booths is giving out ARCs, advanced reading copies. Mm-hmm. So Rainbow Rowell, another author who's very popular right now, was giving out copies of her new book. But going back to John Green, he has more than almost any other young adult author, and more than almost any author, I think, right now, an intense engagement with his fans over social media. So more than any other author, an audience with John Green really is a reason that you would go and wait for 3 hours in a hall with 10,000 screaming teenagers because you feel like you know him. Mm-hmm. Most people do feel.
It is something that happens at Comic-Con. People go and wait for hours to sit in a room full of 1,000 people and watch a trailer.
Watch a trailer they could watch on YouTube a day later.
Which I've always thought was very weird, too. I think the purpose of BookCon is really to be a place for people who read a lot to throng, particularly young people who read a lot. BookCon was very YA-centric. I also went to a very, very well-attended panel with Veronica Roth, who wrote the Divergent books. Mm-hmm. I described the Veronica Roth panel as kind of girl world. Mm-hmm. It's great. It's very unself-conscious girls screaming about books, and it was cool.
Now, Linda, I didn't actually get to go to this, but I know that one of the big things that was going on at BookCon was the We Need Diverse Books panel.
Right. After the panels for BEA had been announced for the actual Book Expo, there was a hashtag that emerged on Twitter and also a campaign on Facebook and some other places called We Need Diverse Books. And it was because the panels at BEA and the major speakers at BEA were very white. So they had done this We Need Diverse Books thing. And there was a panel at BookCon that was made up of diverse authors that was specifically in response to this that I did not get a chance to go to. But as I understand it, there was somebody else from NPR who was going to be there. So I chose not to go to that. But as I understand it, very well attended and very full.
I mean, I guess what's really, really different about a book convention versus a music convention is that it's really easy to sample little bits of each band
right.
before South by Southwest.
Sure.
I mean, it takes a lot of time.
And a lot of what you're doing at Book Expo is agreeing to have them send you stuff later.
Yeah.
Like, I would take a look at that. Send me that book, and I'll take a look at that
and
later.
And sometimes for books that they think are going to be really buzzy, they'll give you a little sampler.
Right.
Harlequin does that. I had this beautiful moment at the Harlequin Teen with Stephen. You will appreciate this. One of their authors is a huge Bob Boylan fanboy.
Ah.
And he said, oh my God, I listen to all songs all the time. Do you know Bob Boylan? And I was like, yes, yes, I know him. I used to sit right next to him.
He's actually not all he's cracked up.
and so this guy insisted on signing a copy of his book for Bob Boylan.
Because he said that
In the first chapter of this book, the excerpt that he was giving me, they listened to All Songs Considered.
Aww.
It's part of the plot.
There you go.
In this Harlequin team.
Yeah.
Cross-pollination.
There you go. Okay, so there is a difference here, because book people are not like other people. And this brings me to my topic that I want to talk about, which are the parties, which is why a lot of people go to Book Expo to schmooze.
Yeah. Like,
what happens after hours, after the center closes and the panels
book
are done.
Book Expo after dark.
Exactly. Now, the reason I wanted to talk about this is, and this is a sweeping generalization, but if I was a guidance counselor and like a kid came up to me who was effusive and loquacious and warm and a people person, I wouldn't look at that kid and say, you know what, book publishing for you. Because, and this is again, sweeping generalization, but book people in the publishing industry are readers. Readers tend to focus inward. So every book party that I've ever been to follows the same arc, which is awkward people in clumps. One or two drinks, Oscar Wilde and Dorothy Parker trading bonbons over the punch bowl, three or four drinks, awkward drunk people. That's the arc of the evening.
But remember, there's a crossover here between book people and publicists.
Yeah.
And
sales reps.
And sales reps.
You leave them out.
And famous people.
Well, and this ties into Glenn's question. Does the convention kind of thrum with literate excitement? Because I feel like there are effusive fans of reading.
Sure. No.
Many of them listen to this show.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about I went to my friend Nathan Englander's book launch back in the 90s. His first book called For the Relief of Unbearable Urges. It was amazing. It was in Sunny Mehta's penthouse apartment. Sunny Mehta is the head of Knopf. You go up the elevator and it opens up onto living room. And I was like, Futiba! We are so conditioned to expect hallway when an elevator opens up, and when it doesn't, it shocks you. There was a servant standing there, and I kept expecting him to ask me for my calling card so we could place it on a little silver tray, or like, could I take your buggy whip, sir? It was very antiquated. But I was there with Nathan. I would let him go off and schmooze. He's great at it, by the way. Of all the writers I know, he is an outlier in that he is charming and can just turn it on. I cannot. So if we go to a party with a lot of strangers, and I come up to you and I don't know you, and you say something remotely funny, we are locked for the evening. You and I are spending the entire time. I'm handcuffed to you, no matter how many hints you send, how many times you look over my shoulder. Unless you throw a smoke bomb and then grapple over to the bean dip, I am with you. There's no escape.
Fair warning for 2014 Comic-Con.
Absolutely. So I was there with Nathan's agent, Nicole, a very patient woman who wasn't there to hang out with a loser like me. She was there to promote her authors, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another of her authors was Juno Diaz. This was back when his first book of short stories was just coming out. And he looked as miserable as I felt. Mm-hmm. So we hung out a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then Chip Kidd came over and we talked about Batman. And I hung on to Chip Kidd for so long that he got tired of talking about Batman. And he excused himself. So my question is the parties. There's a long wind up, but just tell me about what it's like.
Glenn, we solved this problem by going to parties in a cluster of NPR people and standing in the corner talking to each other.
Mm-hmm. Genius.
But I think there's a little bit of a social lubricant that we have that you may not have had at that point, which is that if you tell somebody that you work for NPR. Because, of course, the second question is always, who do you work? You know, what do you do? Right. You know, and you say NPR. And they go, oh, my God, do you know Scott Simon? And then you're off
right,
to the races.
Exactly. They start asking you about other parts of the building that you don't know anything about.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that what's going on there party-wise is that you do have a lot of different kinds of people. Because a party like that is going to have some media people, some publicity people. Only some of them are kind of like hardcore nerd people. I found at the things that I went to that it's a mix of sort of different kinds of folks. But yes, do you run into a lot of people who look really miserable at the amount of attention that is on them? Yes, you do.
Okay.
I saw that at the party that I went to. The thing I went to the first night was a dinner. And there were some authors there who were asked to stand up and talk about their books.
Ugh.
Some of them clearly love it. Mm-hmm. Some of them clearly thrive in that environment. Mm-hmm. Others of them looked like they sort of wanted to die. You know, one of the things that I noticed was, you know, they always will market a book to you by telling you the other books that it is just like.
Right.
And they'll say it's a cross between A and B. And
A is usually Gone Girl.
Yeah. Well, sometimes they will be sort of similar related things. Like, you know, it's a cross between this kind of thriller and this kind of thriller. Other times it'll be like, it's a cross between Gone Girl and a cooking light cookbook. And you'll be like, what?
It's a cross between The Fault in Our Stars.
I would buy that.
Yeah. A cross between The Fault in Our Stars and Grumpy Cat.
I would also buy that.
They're always trying to explain books in terms of other books. And the interesting thing is a lot of people who are there are looking for something new and different and cool. And so there's this weird tension between trying to explain that something is like everything else and trying to explain that it's different and interesting. There's a book that they were promoting called I Take You by a woman named Eliza Kennedy. And they're marketing it by saying this irreverent voice, kind of like Bridget Jones. And I was like, all right, whatever. That seems like the kind of thing that sometimes I like. I got a copy of it and I read it. Not only is this book not Bridget Jones, but this book is sort of the anti-Bridget Jones in the sense that the book is real. And this book does not come out until early next year. I apologize. But the book is really all about ripping apart and digging under all of the assumptions that underlie all these books about single women and relationships and books where a woman is having a relationship with a dude. And it sort of is upending everything up to and including why is getting married important?
Mm-hmm.
Why is monogamy important? Why is cheating considered bad? Why is wanting to sleep with more than one person considered bad? And it's all these things that really are unusual things for a book with a picture of a lady in a dress on the front to be examining.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly this book is written to upend all this stuff. And yet when they promote it, there's an air of it's like if you liked this book, you'll also like this book when it's almost the opposite of that.
Well, that for nonfiction at least, that's part of the process before the book is written. You have to put in your proposal, say, this book is like this book, which was very popular.
Of course. Required. But that's true not only when it's new and not really like that book, but when it's almost the opposite of that book, when it's almost a reaction to that book in a very aggressive kind of way. And I liked the book. I'm not sure I bought, you know, everything about the book, but it was a much more interesting read than the description of it, I think, made it sound.
The tension that I noticed that I think is interesting is that, you know, every year they pick buzz books. They have committees of sort of librarians and booksellers and reviewers, and they pick these, you know, five books that they think are going to be buzzy. And almost invariably, those are not the ones that do
right.
well.
Yeah.
And there's the sort of tension between that and then the hordes of teenagers who are coming to see John mm-hmm. Green and, you know, kids these days. But I think the thing that I take away from that is people who say book publishing is dying are dumb. There were a couple of buzz books that actually looked pretty good to me. One was called The Miniaturist. It's about a miniature painter in 17th century Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
My history nerd heart was warmed by that. Another one is called On Immunity, which looks like it's going to be a very thoughtful critique of the anti-vaccine panic.
Mm-hmm.
So those are two that I think might actually catch on.
Yeah, and the John Scalzi book buzz book,
Scalzi,
too.
Yeah.
So there's a bunch of stuff in there.
He's pretty buzzy already.
Yeah, to look at. And of course, there's always like the new, like there's two. I think we heard pitches for two new Stephen King books. Because, you know, busy guy. Anyway, but come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us what books you're thinking about. And, you know, we can tell you whether we heard anything while we're up there. And that brings us to our next segment. Now, this one came from you guys. One of you had mentioned to us the issue of pop culture that we turn to in times of grief. That was my understanding of the topic. Is that your understanding, Tom?
Yeah, and I got to say, man, going from literacy to grief, it's just finally something in my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
So we had sort of been asked to think about, you know, the cultural objects that you rely on and turn to when you're sad. I'm wondering if Glenn has a taxonomy.
I don't, but I don't question the topic. Here's my thing. When I'm talking about the actual process of grief, as in when somebody dies, like that process is a biological thing that your body puts you through, whether you want to go through it or not. Mm-hmm. It strikes me that the pop culture that speaks to you while you're gripped by grief, it doesn't need to be special, doesn't need to be anything particularly apropos, because what happens with grief is that suddenly everything you read, everything you see, everything you smell, taste, and touch seems to be about this hole in your life. So your baseline narcissism, this is my theory, your baseline narcissism just gets amped up. But it's not, you're not always thinking about you. It just seems that everything around you has to do with this all of a sudden, even if it doesn't. Here's an example. My dad died 3 years ago. The transition between the diagnosis and the death was very quick, so we didn't have a lot of time to prepare. That might factor into this. But a very well-meaning relative gave me a book on grieving that helped her. And that's a thing that didn't speak to me at all. That was a
self-help books didn't speak to you? Like,
it was Stephen, it was so full of platitudes and just cliche and tortured metaphors. And then I'd go over to Mom's house and I'd see all these sympathy cards lined up on her mantle with their sunsets and their sun-dappled meadows and their glaucoma filter lilies. And and I'd open them up and I'd see somebody signing their name to this factory-installed like sentiment, which, by the way, bite me, American Greeting Card Company.
But you can't resent people's desire to...
Here's a tip. When somebody you know dies, rip a piece of paper out of a spiral-bound notebook, scrawl on it a specific memory of that person, send that to the family. That has meaning. That counts. Signing your name... Anyway, tangent.
No. I think you're... that's a worthwhile tangent. I still have a box. My father died 20 years ago.
Yeah.
He edited a magazine about comic books with my mother. And I still have this box of the letters that people wrote.
See?
And the letters, I mean, the cards, yeah, you're right. The cards, I don't want to say the cards mean nothing, because every expression of sympathy means
something.
The cards
mean the person thought of you.
Exactly.
The cards are a box that they checked. I did this
no,
thing that I'm
I
supposed to
do. No, I don't think you're right
yeah.
about that. I think they are more than that sometimes. I think they are the best that the person could think of. We have to remember, you're a writer. It sounds
easy
to you. Well, you
sign
are
my
still
name.
Thinking
I
like
think
a writer.
I think a grieving person can resent whatever the heck they want to resent.
Well, no, of course. But I think when you get into the motive of the other person and you say a card is only sent because the person is checking off a box, I think that is not true.
Well, to be fair, I'm sure a part of my mom was thinking, did I get a card from Aunt Carol?
No, absolutely.
It's like, my thing is... It all sucks.
I still think you're thinking like
it does all suck. And there are other ways that those boxes get checked that your methods may vary. You know, my family lived in a very, very small town. My mother still does. And it's custom in a lot of these small towns. Maybe this was true when your father died. But people would bring casseroles who we didn't know and give us casseroles. And it was fantastic. It was, even though none of us were hungry,
right.
Maybe that's the checking of a box too. But there's a certain amount of this is all I could think of to do. You know, I'm sure September 11th may come up at some point in this conversation,
right.
But at The Onion, the story, not knowing what else to do, woman bakes American flag cake.
There you go.
And not knowing what else to do, there's still that expression of sympathy, whether it's a card or letter. I agree that a letter is so much better than a card.
A note, a sentence.
I predict a grief casserole cookbook at BEA next
year. There you go. All right, so I was cleaning out my dad's office. I was listening, I had my iPod on, and it's funny. This song was actually talked about on the show already by Chris Klimek, but LCD Sound System, Someone Great, came up on the shuffle. And this song is not about death. It's about a breakup. And if you listen to it, it's almost robotic. It is not soaring, sentimental strings Mantovani. It is almost laughably spare. And the lyrics are plain as day. There's nothing reaching or eloquent. A song I knew very, very well. I heard millions of times. And it gets to this one part toward the end that sounds a little like this. When someone great is gone. That is so dumb. That is just somebody saying...
That's dumb?
All it is somebody saying, doesn't it suck? But it broke me. It shattered me completely. And I wasn't prepared for it. I wasn't ready for it. Mm-hmm. It's almost like journalistic. It's like Hemingway saying, doesn't it suck when somebody great is gone? But that's all that I needed to just be shattered. Now, that's an example of pop culture that didn't help me. But I do have an example, another example of something that
did. But breaking you, part of that process is being broken.
Sure, sure, absolutely. But also at the same time, during that same, when I was cleaning out the office, Death Cab for Cuties, I Will Follow You Into the Dark came up. I clicked skip because I've always found that song sentimental and mawkish, and I didn't want it for suddenly to speak to me. So just in the case that it might, I skipped it ahead.
That's for me.
I am immensely lucky at this point in my life to not have experienced the kind of all-consuming grief that you've been talking about. You know, my griefs have mostly been sort of mild breakups and crummy times at work. Mm-hmm. And I sort of have a taxonomy, actually. I think that there are, you know, that some people use pop culture to process what's happening to them. Some people want to find a kinship in it, like, oh, I'm not alone. Some people just want to get the heck away from mm-hmm. whatever's bothering them.
Sure.
And that's me. I'm an escapist. I've talked before. I think you all are sick of the fact that I'm obsessed with Doctor Who and Buster Keaton. But the reason I feel so strongly about those two pop culture properties is that they came to me at times in my life when I desperately needed to not be in this world, mm-hmm. because this world was so uncertain that I didn't know what was happening from week to week, and it was wearing me down to the point where I couldn't think straight, and I needed to not be here. And, you know, during one of those times in my life, I chain watched all of new Doctor Who, and that's why now I hear that theme music, and to me, that's a security blanket made of purring cats and Klonopin. I mean,
sure.
You know,
sure.
Silent movies are a little bit of a harder sell. I mean, it's, you know, it's sort of hard to lose yourself to escape into an art form that's so, so alien to what we now conceive of as a movie. But before I was anything else, I was a historian. And silent movies are the ragged edge of living memory. They're mm-hmm. the sunlight of a day that is 100 years dead. And they're like having a time machine. I mean, you know, they don't work at all anymore. The dialogue is clunky. If there is any, you know, the jokes don't make sense. But somehow I could lose myself in those sort of silver shadows and not be here for a while.
Yeah. You know, I think when people talk about culture and grief, you essentially have... you know, I thought Glenn might have a taxonomy, which I wanted to get to first because I have one, and I don't think it's that, you know, I knew Glenn's would be better.
Yeah, we'll see if we have battling taxonomies because I did bring them as well.
But I think there's three ways to think about it, right? There's wallowing. Wallowing has a way of sounding self-indulgent. That is not what I mean.
You need to wallow.
Wallow is just living in it, right?
Right.
It's almost reinforcing your feelings.
It provides a comfort. It's like picking a scab. It's like putting your tongue in a canker store.
But it's echo. It's just echo your feelings, right?
Yes.
It's just hear your own feelings reflected back to you over and over and over again.
And the hardest thing to do when something is fresh. That's more on the recovery.
Right. But this is, I mean, frankly, this is the Killing Me Softly model, mm-hmm. right? Among all the songs that have been kind of ruined by overplay and people's kind of odd way of thinking about the way they're produced, Killing Me Softly, recorded by a bunch of people, but to me most significantly by Roberta Flack, is really about this very thing. It's about going and listening to a singer who suddenly appears to be singing everything that you're feeling and what an incredibly intense feeling that can be. So that to me is kind of that wallowing feeling. It's just the reinforcing of the sadness that you feel. And I think the phrase Killing Me Softly is very apropos because what she's really talking about, what that song is really talking about is like on the one hand it's terrible, but on the other hand it's very gentle. And so then you have wallowing and then you have comfort, which is things that are reassuring, things that say everything will be okay. I think a lot of times in breakups, this is where the angry song comes in. Mm. This is where the Kelly Clarkson song will enter into your life during the breakup. Is to say that, you know, everything will be okay because heck with that guy or whatever. The third one is things that just make you feel either nothing. Like, for me, sometimes, you know, mainlining a whole bunch of episodes of some reality show is just a distraction from whatever else I'm anxious or upset or unhappy about. because it's just, I do not have to put any emotional energy into it all at all. It's neither comforting nor wallowing. It's just pure exit. Mm-hmm. And I think what I have just said is a much less articulate way of what Patrick was talking about, you know, getting at that idea of kind of leaving the world that you're in. So I think there's a lot of different ways to do it. And when you were talking about the card versus the writing a couple of sentences, one of the reasons why I react to that is I tend to be a person who wants to be comforting to people and struggles miserably when I don't know what to do. And so my guess is that some of those people are in that position where they feel like anything they say is not going to be good enough. They feel like if they sit down to write even a couple of sentences to you, a writer, even to your mother, even to anyone, they're going to feel like they should do more. And so what I am getting at is how you interact with people who are grieving and how you grieve is, like Petra said, a grieving person can be upset about anything they want because it's intensely personal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The whole thing is intensely individual. Some people, when they're sad, they want to hear sad music. Some people, when they're sad, they need to hear happy music.
Right.
It just depends on who you are and how you're processing.
But this is a question that I want to put to Stephen. My theory is that music as a medium is uniquely qualified to help you with wallowing. And also, it's uniquely qualified to lift you out of yourself. My dad liked a hymn called How Great Thou Art. And there's a note in that where somebody says, then sings my soul. And that's the part in the funeral where you can just see everybody lose it.
Then sings my soul, my Savior God to me. How great thou art, how great thou art.
Also, when it's like in O Holy Night, fall on your knees, that fall is the thing that's supposed to just hit you in the sternum. What music I don't think is particularly good at, and I think something like television and movies are better at, is cheering you up, is actually bringing you out of it. Because I just think that grief is such a cloud that if the funeral finishes and you get in your car and you turn on, you know, Walking on Sunshine, it doesn't do anything. It just feels worse. It just makes everything seem tinnier and harsher.
I can't imagine. If I were grieving, hearing that, managed to not swear, that Pharrell song.
Happy.
That like was kind of light and charming the first 750,000 times you hear it. But yeah,
so you're saying that your sympathy card should not be one of those that opens up and plays the Pharrell song when you open the sympathy
card? Don't worry.
Card.
Be happy.
Oh, Glenn, you went there.
I think that for each person, that cheering up aspect of music is going to come from different material. I wrote down a little bit of my own taxonomy, and I wrote down comfort, escape, anger/aggression, and wonder.
And ooh, that's deeper than mine.
And so I'll give an example. They're not all music, but I will get to some music, Glenn. For comfort, it's just whatever records like slow your blood. You know, I got divorced a few years ago, and a record that I went back to again and again and again was this record called Diamond Mine by King Creosote and John Hopkins.
I leave you to grieve. Tear over my letters. Pen frenzy the page. Rain, squall, and all weather.
And it's like 32 minutes long, and it's all sort of set in the Scottish countryside. You know, it's just brogues and these very warm instrumentation. That was a very transporting, you know, you talked about exit, Linda. That's like, that's the comfort in the exit from your life, but it's also, it's petting your head.
Mm-hmm.
That record. Escape for me, yeah, Linda talked about reality shows. For me, like Archer, because there's nothing in Archer that is anything like my life. And even though it's full of yelling and swearing and shooting.
I bet you have ants, Stephen.
That's how you get ants. Anger and aggression, I think in the grieving process, like locating very primal emotions, finding very pure emotions is very, very useful. And in music, it's very easy to find stuff that hits that sweet spot. For me, a few years ago, a lot of Mountain Goats, a lot of Thermals, a lot of just more like white knuckle kind of feeling. But wonder is the trickiest one. And that's where you're finding these sweet spots that are very soaring, but you have to be in the mindset to pursue that. It's not going to work if it's foisted upon you.
Right.
So my favorite album of 2010, which is the year that my ex-wife and I split up, my favorite album was called Go by Yonsei, from Sigur Rós. And it is this very, like, stompy, clappy, soaring, everything in that record is wonder. A band called Cloud Cult had a song called Invocation, You'll Be Bright. You're not in the mood to be transported and uplifted by it. It's not going to work. But I completely seized on that song. Right. And so locating these kind of big emotions, like taking breaks from all emotions is important, but then grasping onto the big emotions is important. It's just all just ways to make time pass.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what helped a lot, which was something I wrote about for the blog years ago, was a book called Special Exits, graphic memoir by Joyce Farmer, which is about her two parents and their slow descent into death and how they cared for each other. And it looks kind of cluttered. It looks, it is almost hard to read visually because it is so cluttered, but that's the point. The point is she's loading it up with specifics. That's where I found help. That's where I found kinship. It's like, this is what fiction does, right? Fiction takes you out of your own head and puts you in somebody else's head and says, here are the specifics of this life. And whether or not they have an affinity with you isn't really, you're not thinking about that at that point. You are just locating your essence in these people who are going through this crap that you remember going through. And it was so not sentimental and not pushing it and just, here are my parents. They loved each other. Now they're gone. It sucks. That's what I wanted to hear. That's mm-hmm. all I needed.
Well, I think this is definitely one where it'd be fascinating to hear what folks think. So come and find us, you know, social media, find us on the blog, let us know what you think. And in another whip turn of the head, that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Grief, no.
Hear the Pharrell song now,
no,
please.
God. No, grief.
Books and grief. No. Well, first of all, I totally, since I go first, I get to bogart all the love of our incredible, awesome, amazing listeners with two little quick notes. One is that our live show for our 200th episode managed to sell out in less than 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, they went on sale. Yeah. Well, we'll get to that in a sec. But they went on sale at 12 o'clock. I refreshed the page at 12:01. It said sold out. I looked at my phone, and then it switched from 12:01 to 12:02. So they sold out in less than 2 minutes. Now, that is a good news, bad news situation. That clearly means we need to have more live shows and possibly bigger venues. Mm-hmm. So we apologize for those who tried to get tickets and couldn't, but there will definitely be more live shows. Also, I posted a little note on our Facebook page, facebook.com/PCHH, last week, said, hey, we could use your ideas for topics. 288 comments as of this taping. So the people who listen to this show are just absolutely astounding. And
you really are. Give yourselves a hug.
There's no way to say that and sound fully sincere, but I fully sincerely cannot appreciate our people.
Hug your neighbor right there on the subway.
A couple other minor notes. I bit the bullet and subscribed to Hulu Plus.
There you go.
Which will give me one more way to access
Sports Night.
Things like
the Supersizers.
Things like, hey, the first 12 episodes of the season of Hell's Kitchen I didn't even know was happening. So I'm excited to one more channel to exit life, Linda would say. I'm excited about the fact that there's going to be a new season of Orange is the New Black, even though I have not finished with the first one. Mm-hmm. And finally, a quick music recommendation. Really terrific record streaming on NPR Music right now, coming out next week by a Swedish duo of sisters called First Aid Kit. The album is called Stay Gold. They started out as this very kind of choral, Fleet Foxy kind of thing and have settled into like a little bit more of a country folk sound that's got a little bite to it. It's terrific. The band is First Aid Kit. The album is Stay Gold.
All right. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Two things. The first one isn't pop culture. It's actually cultural. If one finds oneself in Barcelona, then one really must before one dies. There's so much to do. There's all this. You're going to do the Gaudi stuff. You're going to tick those boxes. This amazing architecture. You're going to go to the markets. You're going to go to the sea. You're going to go to the mountains. It's amazing. It's a wonderful town. You might skip, if you were a churl, as I am, you might skip the National Museum of Catalan Art, which is in this amazing building right at the foot of this beautiful mountain that overlooks the city. Because maybe you've been going to a lot of museums and you've seen a lot of two-dimensional Jesus, you know, two-dimensional Jesus given the two-fingered, like...
That's the name of my first album.
That's right. In so many photos, he's kind of blessing you with the two fingers, so it looks like he's giving you the finger guns, you know? Or sometimes when he's doing it with both hands, he looks like Yosemite Sam. And you're like, I've seen a lot. I would recommend so highly the Museum of Catalan Art. What they've done is they've gone through these ruined churches in the Catalan countryside, which were originally just painted every inch from the apse to the nave with frescoes, and they've taken them off the walls and remounted them in rooms within the museum that have the size and shape of those original churches. So this huge piece is missing because these are ruins.
Right.
They do it for, you know, 500 to the Middle Ages and mm-hmm. into the Renaissance. You can see the symbology of these religious icons coming together. Now, it's not like they're evolving because the symbolism is set in stone. Like, that's Peter, he's got keys. That's a bald guy, that's obviously Paul. This person is carrying a palm frond, that means they were a martyr. All that stuff is set by the church. But there's this style that isn't quite set yet in these very early, like, churches from, like, 500. But as you go from room to room, church to church, century to century, you start to see it all standardize in a really interesting, immediate way, where you can see that at this point in this century, the painters went to Rome, learned what everything's supposed to look like, and then came back, and then all of a sudden it gets much more standardized. It's just fascinating. And the audio guide is by Jim Dale, the actor who did the, among other things, he did the audio books for Harry Potter. So you keep waiting for him to go, Harry, you know, the way he used to do with Hermione. Maybe. But he doesn't do that. Second thing, I have recommended on this show a podcast before. Yes?
You have.
Okay.
I'm almost sure that's happened.
I have recommended RuPaul on this show before. I recommended podcast interviews with RuPaul on this show before. I'm doing it again. Here's why. Not because of RuPaul himself, because in this particular interview, he's very much himself. He's kind of morphing into this second phase of his life where he's becoming a motivational speaker,
right.
Sort of a self-help guru,
right. Yep.
In that he speaks entirely in metaphors nowadays, mm-hmm. and in a way that self-help gurus tend to do that passes for wisdom, even if it's not actually, mm-hmm. there's not actual wisdom there. But mm-hmm. that's not aside. It's not about the RuPaul. It's about the dynamic, the specific chemistry of this interview, which is with Marc Maron on the show WTF.
Yeah.
Marc Maron is the physical manifestation of cynicism and judgment and resentment. RuPaul is the physical embodiment, the avatar of, like, expansiveness. They come together. And as Julie Klausner pointed out on her podcast, RuPaul spends a lot of time gay-splaining to Marc.
Yeah.
Marc has some questions. Mm-hmm. Listen to the good-naturedness of RuPaul in this clip.
Who are your role models for your the sort of dynamic you were like? Who are your female role models?
Well, it had always been Cher and Diana Ross, you know, that kind of thing. It
right,
was the typical things, that type of glamour and that type of
why
spectacle.
Cher? Why is it always Cher?
I'll tell you why. Because she this is the same with all of the gay female icons throughout. Joan Crawford, Judy Garland, because these people embody the duality of strength and vulnerability. They have both the power and the softness. They're both. They're.
I always wondered this.
This is actually why.
Okay, so what you hear in that is Marc Maron's discomfort. He's really kind of stumbling over his words. He's not.
What
sure.
about the? Is it?
And how does RuPaul come back? I'll tell you why. Mm-hmm. This is exactly why. Mm-hmm. That is just such a perfect little combination there.
Yeah.
And then it ends in this really nice little sweet note like this.
I know. So I can maybe I'll go get some dresses.
You know, you can get dresses. You can do whatever. How long have you had that shirt you're wearing right now?
It's pretty new.
Is it?
Well, I mean, I got it. Like I got it from the TV show. They bought it for uh-huh. me. So, you think I need a new shirt?
Well, you know.
Oh, man, I just love that. It's like they're coming together, and these two people who don't have anything in common, and yet they're finding out that they do. It's actually kind of moving in a way. So that's the RuPaul interview with Marc Maron on WTF.
Fantastic. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Petra Mayer, what is making you happy this week?
If you can't learn to love yourself, Glenn, how the hell are you going to love somebody else? Can I get an amen in here?
Fly, fly, fly.
Well, Drag Race always makes me happy. And I will also say that as far as Barcelona goes, the red wine that comes in the tan box with Don Quixote on it also made me very happy when I was in Barcelona. Mm-hmm. I mean, never mind the museums. I spent most of my week in Barcelona smashed out of my mind on red box wine, which was delicious.
Nice.
Delicious.
Yeah. Nice. Thank you.
So as to what's really making me happy, I feel like I'm being kind of repetitive this week because I've reiterated all of my pop culture crushes, and now I'm going to go right back to the fantasy YA female-centered well, although not teenage nun assassins. This time it's teenage schoolgirl necromancers. Garth Nix, the YA author, has a series called the Old Kingdom series. It has wonderful female characters, wonderful world building. It's set in this world sort of which straddles a divide between magic and technology. In the south, technology works. In the north, magic works. And there's a divide between life and death, and the death are always trying to come back into life. And oh, it's just so imaginative and wonderful. And there were three books in this series, and then a fourth sort of collection of short stories, and I loved them to death. And I sort of made my peace with the fact that there weren't going to be any more of them. But I was sad, but I was accepting. So when I was at Book Expo, I was in this long, long, long meeting with some publicists in a windowless room. And I kind of staggered out of there and straight into this line of people, and almost literally straight into this one girl who was carrying a book that said Clariel on the title. And I said, Clariel, that sounds like a Garth Nix book. Is that really a Garth Nix book? Oh, my God. He's written a sequel to the Old Kingdom trilogy. A prequel. He's written a prequel to the Old Kingdom trilogy. And of course, because I had been in that meeting, not only did I miss the signing at the booth, but they had given out all of the advance reading copies that were available. So it's a bittersweet sort
They'll
of happy for
one.
Me. But just knowing that I can go back again to this world that I loved so much is making me incredibly happy. And for all of you eager readers out there, the first book in the trilogy is called Sabriel. It is really, really good. Go read it right now.
Wonderful. Thank you, Petra Mayer. Two things. While I was at Book Expo, I got to go to an event at Housing Works in New York, the bookstore cafe, and I saw my pal, Rainbow Rowell. She was going to read from her new book, which is called Landline and is not quite out yet. But as it turned out, the other person on the bill with her, who also has a book out, is John Darnielle of the Mountain Goats. Mm-hmm. And Rainbow is very attached to John Darnielle and listened to a lot of John Darnielle while she was writing her previous book, Eleanor and Park. So I think when she realized that she was reading with John Darnielle, she scrapped her plan to read from her new book, which she's trying to sell, and read from Eleanor and Park. And as she was explaining why this music had meant so much to her and was so important to her during her writing, but also during her life, she was very weepy and everyone else was very weepy. And it was just one of those wonderful, wonderful things. And I got to see her read. And then I got to see John Darnielle read. And the whole thing was really pretty fantastic.
Wow, what a convergence of great things.
It was great. It was really, really good. You would have enjoyed it quite a lot.
I was so sad I couldn't go to that party.
Yeah, I dragged myself out when I was very tired. So you know how much it meant to me. More impartially, the New York Times ran a profile within the last couple of days of Damon Lindelof, who was one of the creators of Lost. It's a profile by Taffy Brodesser Ackner. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that name. It covers kind of this time after he became sort of this giant punching bag over the end of Lost. And I think it becomes a really important story because he is a guy who, partly because he was on social media and had a lot of direct contact with fans, has just transparently suffered over it's not a matter of like, oh, my feelings are hurt because people didn't like my show. I think that would have been normal. And I think he would have dealt with it. But because he was a presence on Twitter, people would just come back over and over and over again. And for whatever reason, and frankly, the more they could tell that he felt it and it bothered him, the more they did it. And people just were cruel and awful. As you read this profile, you realize that these people, in going beyond criticism of the work, which I think is fair, and making the person into sport, have actually taken a human being and made his life worse. Somewhat similar to almost like what happened to Bill Buckner in Boston.
Oh, wow.
For me, and I'm an outspoken advocate of the end of that show, or at least defender of the end of that show. And for me, to pick out that guy who tried so hard, whether you think he failed or succeeded, to tried so hard in this hugely ambitious way to wrestle with these really big ideas about love and death and faith, and writes these really fabulously interesting stories, even if you think he doesn't know how to pull off endings, to pick that guy and just say, I'm just going to hammer at that guy until he can't take it anymore, is a really ugly part of the culture. And I think for anyone who writes criticism, it is really important to sometimes read those pieces and just force yourself to differentiate over and over again between, I don't like this show, I didn't like this ending, I think this is lousy writing, or even, I think this is offensive, or I think it's sexist, or I think whatever. Between that and taking this person and saying, I am just going to hound this guy personally, directed at him, I am going to hound him until he goes away and can't write anymore, which really seemed to be part of what went on with him. So I felt like this profile was really important and really well written, and we'll link to it. And I can be as blistering as anyone in criticism of pieces, but I think it's very important to visit these stories every now and then. And remember that it's people, it's human beings, and you want to stay on the right side of the line. Anyway. So I think it's a very good piece and, you know, not necessarily happy making, but really, I'm really glad that it exists and was written. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow Petra at Petramatic, P-E-T-R-A-M-A-T-I-C. Petra is also the voice of the NPR Books Twitter feed, which is at NPR Books. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, R-E-E-D-Y, and our producer, Nick Fountain, at Nick Fountain. Nick, like Nick, Fountain, like Fountain. You can follow also, as always, our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts that we think you would enjoy. For word games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts, check out Ask Me Another. It's a rambunctious hour that blends brain teasers with comedy and music. Find Ask Me Another on iTunes under podcasts.